Thank you everyone for coming. I'm Will Eng from Penn State, and this is work in collaboration with Intel Labs and Duke University. So in the second quarter of this year, over 60 million smartphones were sold worldwide. And in the third quarter, it's probably going to be more. A smartphone is simply a phone that allows users to download and run third-party applications from the internet. And when those applications run, they gain access to the information and resources on that phone. Things like your location, the microphone, the camera, and identifiers that can be mapped back to you. Now, unfortunately, there's no privacy latch for phones. And once an application gains access to some type of information, it's very hard to understand what it's going to do with that information. And when an application does something we don't expect, we become surprised. So if we go back to July of this year, there was a security company by the name of Lookout that found a wallpaper application for Android that was sharing the phone number with the developer's server. And this made the news because no one expected that a wallpaper application was going to be using your phone number in this way. Now, ultimately, Google looked into this, and they said there was nothing malicious happening. But let this be a larger cautionary tale that applications are doing things with our information that we may not know and we may not be comfortable with. And this leads us to a more general challenge with security and privacy that's occurring right now with smartphones. We want our applications to get access to this valuable information like location. But we also don't want to have to trust that they're not going to abuse that information. And this work today I'm going to talk about today is looking at just one piece of the larger privacy pie. We want to look at how do we understand what applications are doing with this information? How do we look inside the application and say, this is what what's happening with our location, our microphone, and different sources of identifiers that are on that phone. And so we're not going to be able to directly say these are privacy problems, but we're going to be able to say very valuable things about what's happening. This is a necessary step in understanding the challenges in this area. So our goal, again, is to develop a monitoring system for a smartphone platform to find when information leaves the phone. And there are a number of challenges associated with this. First, it's a smartphone. So they're resource-constrained devices, and we still care a lot about energy on these devices. And any performance overhead you have to do this monitoring is going to result in more energy consumption. Next, there are a number of types of information that we look for. I saw in the previous slide, location, microphone, and all of these things we want to track simultaneously. So we're going to need more sophisticated algorithms to do that. The information itself changes in different ways. Location changes as you move locations, so the actual coordinates that you're looking for are different. So that means just scanning network packets isn't going to find everything, even if that information isn't encoded or encrypted in some way. And finally, applications can share information with one another. They're sharing with other third-party applications, system applications. On the Android platform, for example, there's an application that acquires the location information directly from the GPS hardware, but then it shares that information with other applications. So we want something more holistic and system-wide in our tracking as opposed to looking at any specific application in isolation. And this led us to using the sort of general established technique of dynamic taint analysis, which is commonly called taint tracking. And the idea is you identify taint sources, which is the information where you know what type it is, and taint sinks, which is the place that you're interested if that information goes. And you want the system then to automatically propagate taint markings on information as it's used in the system. So as you see in the very simple piece of code here, you have your taint source, which might be your location API. A variable comes out of that C. You're going to assign a taint marking to that variable. As the application uses that information, for example, A equals B plus C, well, now A is derivative information of C, so you want to propagate that taint marking. And then eventually, when A is being used in the network send operation here, we can look at A and we can say there's an information dependency between A and that taint source that we cared about. Now, commonly, this tracking is done at the instruction level, which you might imagine has quite a bit of performance overhead. And this leads us to one of our greatest challenges of this work is how do we make different trade-offs, and we're going to do it in terms of granularity, to gain performance such that we can work in this environment. So the system we built, we called TaintDroid, which is a system-wide integration of taint tracking within the Android platform. Consequently, we had some news on this project last week, and Techland.com decided to name us as having the worst recent product name, usurping the Dell streak from the previous title. But as you saw in the previous slide, we're using this taint tracking technology, which is sort of how the name comes about. But in the figure here is sort of an architecture you might see on a smartphone, where you have applications running in some virtualized environment, whether it's Android or BlackBerry, you have this occurring. And then within, we're going to do some tracking at a variable level within that virtual machine environment. But these applications can execute native methods, and we want to make sure after those native methods execute, we can patch the virtual machine in sort of tracking state in response to that. And then when applications are sharing information with one another and writing information to files, we correctly propagate the information and the markings we have. So starting with the virtual machine interpreter, Android applications are written in Java but then compiled into a special machine bytecode language called DEX, which executes in this Dalvik virtual machine interpreter. And so we modify the Dalvik virtual machine interpreter to store and propagate taint tags on variables. Now, a taint tag is just a set of taint markings, so it might contain location, microphone, camera, and different phone identifiers. And we support up to 32 simultaneous taint markings. We use a 32-bit vector to do that. And we're going to store these taint tags very close to variables, actually adjacent to them in memory. And this design choice is very valuable because that means that our taint tags have spatial locality to the information that they refer to. These instructions are constantly occurring, and you want to be able to have quick access to that information. Now, the downside is, even if a variable doesn't have a taint marking on it, you need to store that taint tag for it, which is going to increase the amount of memory that you use. I'm going to have a few slides, some benchmarks with that, and the memory overhead actually isn't too bad for this situation. And the last thing is that we need to make space for these taint tags throughout the virtual machine interpreter at different spots where variables are stored, which means we need to make a lot of changes, which is hard to debug if you've ever debugged a virtual machine interpreter, that things like math just stop working when you have some errors. So Dalvik stores variables in different ways. So let's start with the local variables and method arguments. It stores them on an internal execution stack, where every time a method's called, you have a new stack frame that's pushed onto this stack. And there's 32-bit registers to store the different values. And so we interleave the taint tags between the variables on the stack. Of course, variables can also be 64 bits in size, spanning two registers, and you have to be very careful of how you interleave these taint tags. Next, for classes, the fields in classes are fortunately stored adjacent to one another in the dynamic objects within the interpreter. And again, we interleave our taint tags there, so very similar process for that. And finally, for arrays, we decided to store just one taint tag per array. This design decision was made primarily for performance and memory overhead because a lot of the arrays that you're going to find in this environment are strings. And the string would have entirely the same taint tag associated with it. And otherwise, you'd have to be adding individual taint tags per character. So that's how we store our taint tags. The next step is how do we propagate these taint tags as that execution environment is going. And I may have mentioned before that this Dalvik virtual machine environment has a new machine language that we have to create a taint propagation logic for. We follow the standard techniques of using a data flow semantics for this, just like I described earlier with that A equals B plus C. But we had to add some things. Traditional thing you add with taint propagation is the index on an array lookup. Translation tables are a common way of why you might want to have this. If you're going between ASCII and Unicode, the tainted value might be your index to that array, and you want that to be propagated to the output of the array itself. We had to go a bit further. Sometimes that array might contain a container object, and so the contents of the array is actually an array reference itself. And so if that container object, like an integer class, you actually want that taint to be propagated to the scalar value inside of that integer. So if you include the object reference in your propagation logic, you can achieve that semantics. It's a nice example and details of how this works and why we needed this in the paper if you're interested. So applications are executing inside of this environment. We're tracking the taint on variables within here, but applications can also execute native methods using the Java native interface, the JNI interface. And there's a number of system libraries on an Android phone that are being executed by these applications. Originally, Android didn't support third-party native libraries. They do now. A design choice we made was to restrict the execution of functions to only those that reside in native libraries that are part of the system, so we don't support the third-party libraries. But we needed to do this because if we want to actually track this untrusted code, we need to do some sort of dynamic binary translation or something similar, which is very heavyweight. So to provide this environment, we chose that route. So what happens when an application executes one of these native methods, for the known methods, we know what their data flow semantics are going to be, so we can write different method profiles for them to automatically patch the virtual machine interpreter state after they execute. And we also develop some heuristics to help out that you don't have to write as many rules. Next, when applications talk to one another over IPC, we use a message-level granularity for the tracking of that. We consider looking at a more finer granularity, actually trying to do variables inside of the IPC messages. However, we found that Android applications, they control the logic for marshaling and unmarshaling data items inside of those IPC messages. And there's some very subtle ways that an application can manipulate the size of variables that they're trying to marshal or unmarshal out of there that might remove those taint tags. So we decided to be conservative and use the message level. And next, finally, when applications write information to a file, we use a file-level granularity. We store the one taint tag and an xadder associated with the file. So that's sort of a nutshell of how the system is built. Made a number of different design choices to give us better performance, determine the granularity. So here's just a quick look at the performance of TaintDroid, which is one of our major challenges. So we use the Caffeine Mark benchmark. It's a standard Java benchmark. The scores don't mean anything by themselves. They're very good for relative comparisons. Just know that higher is better. It's some approximation of Java instructions executed per second. But that doesn't matter quite so much here. What matters here is that TaintDroid only has a 14% overhead in the execution of the CPU-bound benchmark within the virtualized environment, which is pretty good. Next, memory overhead. I mentioned before, we're storing these taint tags for every variable, regardless of whether or not there's a taint marking on that variable. So we have only a 4.4% memory overhead for doing that. This is primarily because we're only storing these taint tags associated with data and not code. And also, this virtualized environment is only one part of the overall process that's there. IPC latency was a little bit more overhead. We had about a 27% overhead for the IPC latency. Of course, this happens significantly less than the individual instructions that are executing. And we also did some different macro benchmarks to get a feel for what it's like to execute a phone with this and sort of quantize this a little bit more. Overall, the individual macro benchmarks had pretty minimal perceived overhead to them. One in particular, the taking a picture, I had about a half a second overhead for that, although the Nexus One phone we were testing on already took 1.7 seconds to record the picture, which was a little unexpected in of itself. This was primarily due to the way that we interacted with the storage, with the xadders, and we have some suggestions in the paper of how you might improve or have less overhead for doing storage, taint propagation. So we have our system. We have the taint propagation working within this environment. We've integrated into the firmware. And we have a rather performant system here, but now we need to do something with it. But before we can do something with it, we need to know what we're looking for. So we need to define our taint sources and our taint sinks within this system. A taint sink's pretty easy. We want to define when information leaves the phone over the network interface. So we found the last spot that variables are within the Java environment before they hit the CSocket APIs. The taint sinks the taint source is a little bit more difficult because we're looking at a number of different types of information that are coming out of these interfaces in different ways. As you see in the slide here, these are the different taint sources that we looked at. And I categorize them by the different properties of the APIs that you access them with. For example, low bandwidth sensors, like the location accelerometer, you're going to get those values out in the form of variables. So you can just taint those variables when they come out of the API. High bandwidth information, for example, your camera or microphone input, sometimes you get a buffer array that you can taint coming out of the API, but there's other cases in Android where the developer is actually passing a file descriptor to that API, and that information is written directly to that file. So instead of tainting a variable, you need to go and taint that file. Next, information databases, things like your address book or SMS storage. We looked at different ways of how we might use that as a taint source. But the interfaces that are provided are very generic, and it would be difficult from that API to distinguish between the address book and some other storage that's for the application. So we found the best way to do this was to taint that file when it's created. Now, the limitations here is that all information in that file needs to be of the same type, which is going to restrict the granularity that you can place on these taint sources. And finally, the device identifiers are coming out of APIs in the form of variables. We can just taint those variables directly. One of the taint sources, the IMSI in particular, we found was interesting because in the IMSI, which is the subscriber ID, there's a country code and a network code which are used as a configuration parameter. And this information propagates in different IPC messages that go out. And this caused a number of false positives in our tracking of this because all the information in that message then became tainted as being of the IMSI type. So we ultimately decided not to use the IMSI as a taint source because of this, which demonstrates the limitation due to our granularity that we decided to use. However, we had a lot of other very valuable taint sources that worked within the granularity restrictions that we use for our for optimizations. So this is what we looked at in terms of types of information. What did we find? So we investigated a number of different applications. We started out with a list of the top 50 most popular free applications in all the categories of the Android market. And that gave us 1,100 applications. We further pruned this list down by looking at the applications that had access to the internet and different sensitive information like location, camera, and microphone. That gave us 358 applications. From that 358 applications, we randomly selected 30 of them to look at. You see those applications listed on the slide. And we experimented with them. We ran those applications. We captured the network logs. We looked at the Taintroid logs. We looked for EULAs, different user interface notifications that information may have been shared in some way. And we looked at the results. So this experiment gave us over 1,000 TCP connections. Taintroid identified 105 of those TCP connections as containing sensitive information. We verified that each of those were actually accurate of containing sensitive information. Of the 105 flags, 37 of them were clearly legitimate. Something like this location was used to show the user a map. So it was, the user was very aware that this location was being shown. But the remaining 68 flags, we weren't quite sure why they occurred. So we wanted to investigate them a bit further. And so the first type of information we looked at and sort of categorized was location. And so of the 30 applications that we studied, we found that 15 of them were sharing the location with a third-party advertisement server without notifying the user that this practice was occurring. And this happened in different ways. Usually it was in plain text. As you see in the slide, here is an HTTP GET from the query to the AdMob API. And right in the GET, you see here are our coordinates. But also in here are our other parameters, these S&T parameters, which were associated with that. And we looked across different of these HTTP GETs with different applications. We found the same S&T parameters being duplicated across these. So now not only do we have our location being shared, but we have unique identifiers for that phone that are being associated with that. Now, none of these cases was the user made aware of this. Two applications had a EULA with them, but neither of those EULAs said anything about sharing location. And it happened at different frequencies. One application was as frequent as every 30 seconds, which probably corresponded with the refreshing of an advertisement. But there was another application that we saw the sharing, and it wasn't even running at all. This was happening from the background. So lots of different behaviors were observed from these applications. The next area we looked at were phone identifiers. And so there's a number of different types of phone identifiers we looked at. We classified the device identifier as the IMEI, International Equipment Identifier, from the other ones, because it's sort of used in a little bit different way. We found that 7 applications were sharing that with some remote server without our knowledge. And there were 2 applications that were sharing our phone number, IMSI, and ICC ID, which is a SIM card identifier with some remote server. The remote server was most likely the developer. We can't say for sure who it was. But we were able to identify that it was some remote server associated with the device in some way. A note on the IMSI, I mentioned before that we didn't use that as a taint source, but we saw it in the network packet. It was set in plain text, so we decided it would be good to report that we found that as well. Now, for the IMEI, there's actually 2 additional applications that had network packets containing IMEI information. The first application actually had a EULA associated with it that said, hey, I'm going to send the IMEI off the device. And the other one sent a hash of the IMEI off the device. And so this is useful because it says that developers are aware that these are privacy-sensitive values and some users might care if I start using them in different ways. But that's not to say that the other uses of this information was malicious. It may just be another case of developers being a little overzealous in their data collection. So all we were able to identify is that this information left the device, and we're not trying to say what actually happened with that information once it left the device. We found a number of very interesting things between these two parts of the study of and so shows a lot of value for the Tantroid tracking system. However, there are limitations to what we can track. I mentioned we use a data flow semantics for our propagation logic. These are explicit flows. So that means that we're not tracking implicit flows that are occurring. So an application could launder in different ways the taint markings off of variables. However, tracking implicit flows requires a different set of tools, a different set of trade-offs, which is something to potentially look for in the future. The other limitations were with the taint sources. I mentioned these, the granularity with the IMSI, because these configuration variables were in there, and also with the file databases of all the information needs to be in that. It's going to restrict the coarseness of your taint sources. So to summarize this, we built the Taintroid tracking system, which is an efficient system-wide dynamic taint tracking for Android. We're going to make the source code for this available very soon. We're hoping to get it out there by next Wednesday. We've already had over 260 requests for this, for the source code, since we announced Taintroid last week. We looked at 30 different applications, and we found that 20 of them were sharing information in ways that we didn't expect. So this really meets our goal of understanding what applications are doing with their information. I already mentioned this is just one piece of a larger privacy pie. Now we know what applications are doing. We have the means of identifying that. The next step is to do something with that information. Do we show it to the user, for example? Can we use it for an enforcement mechanism? Maybe there's better ways of using it. Maybe users opt into running Taintroid and send the instances of this shared information back to a central server, some experts using some crowdsourcing techniques to inform people what are happening with their applications. And maybe these third-party security service companies like Lookout and WhatApp that are already looking at privacy on applications on these phones can use Taintroid as a better tool to automatically find potential problems that they can investigate. So I got a little bit of time, and we have a demo that's going to start up here to show Taintroid in action. And someone, fortunately, created a nice user interface for us. And so this is that live wallpaper application. There's that wallpaper application I mentioned in the beginning of the talk that was sending the phone number. And so the application has been opened. It's closed, and up in the top, if you can see it, there is a little icon of the Taintroid saying, hey, there was a piece of sensitive information that was sent out. Go ahead and click on that notification part. And here we see the network buffer that was sent out. And in here, you can identify the different parts. I'm not going to show you the whole, just sort of there's another sample well that sort of highlights this information. But you can check out the whole demo online. So with that, I'd like to thank you and ask if there's any questions. There's also the members of our team, almost all of them are here. So if afterward the session, if you'd like to ask us all some questions, we're available. Thank you.
Hi, Iqbal Muhammad, Microsoft Research. So I really like the work. So I have a question about the implicit flow. So I know that you guys did not cover that. So for instance, timing attacks, or you know, if I'm basically saying if a bit is 1, I'm going to vary my time versus if a bit is 0, and sort of implicitly, you know, do something different.
Right.
So you said you're not covering that, and you said it requires different sets of tools. So can you just elaborate a little bit on like where you think this is going with implicit flows?
So with implicit flows, if you want to fully capture implicit flows, you need to do static analysis. There are some subsets of that you can look at without. For example, if you know the scope of a branch, and the attained value is used in a conditional, you would be able to define a taint scope. This has been done in some research. So anything that's assigned inside of that taint scope, you would say as being influenced in some way. Of course, this is going to cause a lot of false positives. So there's limitations in that as well. So there's lots of different trade-offs, which is why I didn't sort of go into that in depth.
Vovo Kuznetsov, EPFL. So very nice work. I almost decided to throw away my Android device. So in accordance to research vision papers that we have on this conference about testing as a service, have you thought about providing this tool as a web service so that users could upload application and test whether it's privacy, whether that application has privacy issues or not?
So you're asking if we've thought about creating sort of a service where you can upload the application
yes.
package and then have it run.
Yes.
We haven't thought about that specific model. We've talked about different ways that you might be able to use Taintroid to look at that. Trying to think of what sort of limitations you would have I'm not quite sure sort of the interaction with that, but that's definitely a potential way to look at it. Thank you.
Nice work.
Etienne Lesser, UNSW and Nectar. I'm thinking a malicious app, for example, writes a file to your file system. TaintDroid adds the X attribute. How do you envisage stopping the application itself, modifying its own X attributes to remove the taint, for example?
So extended attributes aren't used for anything inside of Android.
Right.
So we could modify. You can do this with LSMs pretty easily, of restricting who can read and write those.
Even stopping an application that owns a file modifying.
In order to access those, you need to be executing different native libraries that are there. These APIs aren't available within that application, and restricting the third party native libraries, so you wouldn't be able to access them from the Java environment.
Right.
Okay. So
I see it being a problem, though, right?
There are potential different things with our threat model, assuming that the native code is trusted. With respect to the profiles we can create for them, it's less of a problem.
Right.
But I see your concern. Yes.
Hi, Lorenzo Cavallaro, Free University of Amsterdam. Very nice work. And I was just wondering if you guys, as a kind of a follow up question on the implicit flows, are you guys planning to do anything for control dependencies? And if yes, how would that impact the performance and the false positive? Because it seems to me that right now, false positives are a bit high. So
you say right now, false positives are a bit high?
Yeah, you said that on over 105 flag connections, I think.
The flag.
35s were legit, so the difference,
right, so,
the
so
difference is
right.
Not legit.
So we're positives. Not attempting to identify privacy violations. The point of this tool is to identify privacy-sensitive information has left the phone. We were accurate in detecting that privacy-sensitive information has left the phone. Using that information is sort of the next steps of what sort of other heuristics can we take into play to understand that.
Okay.
So does that answer the question that you had?
Yeah.
Or,
okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Hi, David Greenaway from UNSW and NICTA. Very impressive results. My question is that now that TaintDroid is public and presumably future malicious authors are going to know about TaintDroid and can launder the data, what do you kind of see as the future purpose of TaintDroid?
So it's obviously there are ways of getting around it, mentioned with the implicit flows. And an application trying to get around it can do so. And so that's why we're going to look at some different techniques. However, A lot of this activity is going on. They're not necessarily maliciously doing that, so you're still going to be able to catch a lot of that low-hanging fruit for quite some time, I think.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering. It seems like one of the common themes is that everyone's surprised when a wallpaper application is looking at your phone number at all, let alone letting it leave the phone. But on the other hand, nobody's particularly surprised when the Show Me Where My Friends Are on a Map application looks at your location and your address book. But there's no way to know if that application is also sharing that information with a server, which may or may not be providing useful information the app needs, or just logging it on the server. I'm wondering the same goal here. Nobody's surprised. Everybody's surprised when you share with an ad server, but if you're sharing it with maps.yourapplication.com, then you're less surprised. Is it possible that a lot of applications would just be hiding whatever traffic they want to track in a legitimate use? And do you have any idea of how to solve that problem?
It's definitely a tough challenge of understanding how that information is going to be used. If you're sending your location to some content server and they're going to give you some functionality based on that specific value that was sent to them, there's not a whole lot you can do with sending your location directly. There are protocols. I think the EFF has a nice website on locational privacy, and there are some citations of different papers that have more privacy-preserving location-based services, and so you'd want to integrate those sort of technologies into sort of the ideal solution.
Okay. Thanks.